the spotlight.
As if the bombing carried out by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen was not bad enough, which has included targeting Yemen's airport in Sana'a, the WFP, World Food Program, has announced that it was forced to cut aid to Yemen due to lack of funds, warning of a surge in hunger in the war-torn country. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why there's a will when it comes to selling Saudi Arabia military arms and weapons, but not enough of one to help the country on a humanitarian basis.
A Saudi attack hit Sana'a International Airport on Monday. The airport in the Yemeni capital has been one of the main targets of the Saudi military campaign since it began more than 6 years ago. And the recent raid caused severe damage to the facility.
The navigation equipment at the airport was broken 2 days before the airstrike. We have sent a letter to the relevant organization and have purchased the equipment for the tower. The equipment here has been used for more than 7 years, and the related accessories are not available at the local market. In order to ensure the safety requirements applicable to international standards, the Sana'a International Airport System has been unable to operate. Now you can see that the refueling equipment has been completely destroyed after the air attack, along with the refueling vehicles.
Flights into the airport have largely ceased due to the Saudi-led blockade since August 2016. 8 flights, however, were exempted, but now they're suspended following the Monday attack. Saudi Arabia has intensified its air raids on Yemen in recent weeks. That comes as the Yemeni army and its allied Ansar Allah forces are moving closer to fully liberate Ma'rib province, a key region and a major stronghold of the loyalists of the Saudi-backed former regime. Riyadh began its war on Yemen to reinstate that friendly regime led by Abdul Rabbah Mansur Hadi. That goal, however, has not materialized, with the civilian population only bearing the brunt of the war. The UN says hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians have been killed, while many more face lack of basic supplies. On Wednesday, the World Food Program warned that it will have to reduce food rations for millions of Yemenis because it's running out of funds.
From January, 8 million will receive a reduced food ration, while 5 million at immediate risk of slipping into famine conditions will remain on a full ration.
The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, has alarming figures, too. It says about 2.3 million children under the age of 5 suffer from acute malnutrition. Of them, 400,000 are expected to face life-threatening severe malnutrition in the coming months. All those figures are the latest that international bodies have provided to show how life goes on for Yemenis under relentless Saudi strikes and its blockade. But the international community takes no practical action to end the Saudi war. Riyadh's Western allies are silent, too, despite their claims of being the world's leading human rights defenders.
For guests joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have Brett Yonkers, historian and journalist from Hassel. Also joining us is Robert Fantina, author, journalist, and activist, who joins us from Kitchener, Ontario.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Brittany Ockers, I'll start with you in taking a look at an occurrence here that is very alarming, and that is how Saudi-led coalition forces is targeting Yemen's airport in Sana'a. What is the purpose behind that? We know, obviously, that that airport, if it's used, is used for humanitarian purposes as far as we know.
Yes, indeed. That is the aggravating and very, like, to the most horrible thing about all of this, aside from the fact that they are bombing a civilian airport. The most aggravating thing is this is not a military airport, but it's not even a normal standard civilian airport, which has an economic purpose for a normal situation. You know, you could say that in other circumstances, perhaps Saudi Arabia was thinking of disrupting, you know, Yemen's economy in order to force the people to surrender. And that's why they're bombing the airport. That by itself would still be a war crime, and at least there would have been some sort of logic behind it. No, what makes this worse is that Sana'a International Airport isn't even a regular functioning commercial airport either. It hasn't been since at least 2016 because of the total blockade, aerial, land, and naval blockade that exists against Yemen. There are no flights, commercial flights, in and out of Yemen. There haven't been in years. The only use that Sana'a International Airport has seen for at least the past 5 years is humanitarian aid, is UN flights, in the United Nations, UNICEF, things at the World Food Program. They are all sending humanitarian life-saving aid to more than 50% of the population in the entire country through either naval transport through Hodeidah port, which is also very often under blockade and under bombing, or through air transport to Sana'a International Airport. We have seen just recently, just days ago, it was mentioned in the topics of the day, just now on Press TV as well, just days ago, Hassan Irlu, the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen, died of COVID-19 complications because of the fact that it took so long to get a proper safe flight out of Sana'a, even for diplomatic personnel like him, to get a safe flight out of Sana'a to go to Iraq and eventually to return to Iran for medical treatment. It took so long that eventually it killed him. So that goes to show that this airport is used exclusively for humanitarian purposes, and even that the Saudis are trying to prevent, just to kill more Yemenis and to increase the suffering even further.
Okay, let's talk about the humanitarian situation. We have to, Robert Fantina. We've been talking about it for, as far as I remember, but it's going on about 6 years or more. And the World Food Program has came out with an alarming announcement that is forced to cut the aid due to a lack of funds, as it has said. And it has warned, as a result of that, a surge to happen in hunger in the in Yemen, which it said from January, 8 million will receive a reduced food ration. I'm quoting the WFP spokesperson, while 5 million will be at immediate risk of slipping into famine conditions and will remain on a full ration. This coming from the UN agency, actually, who said in a statement, because they're running out of funds. What can be done when you hear about this alarming announcement coming from the WFP at a country that's already ravaged by shortage of food and other deficiencies that it's experiencing?
There is so much that can be done. But I'm glad you mentioned the fact that these figures, shocking as they are just a continuation of the conditions that have existed in Yemen for a number of years now, of the amount of people starving and close to starvation, homeless because of bombing, exposed to the elements, unable to get medical treatment, and so on. It has been horrific for years now. And what can be done today? So much can be done. First of all, the United States, which supports Saudi Arabia in every way imaginable, sells it weapons that it uses on many people, supports it diplomatically. The United States could prevent it. The United States could simply say, this isn't going to happen anymore, and tell Saudi Arabia to stop the bombing, and the United States could provide humanitarian aid, all the humanitarian aid that Yemen needs, if it chose to do so. However, that would impede or reduce the profits that United States companies make on their weapons. It would do nothing to enhance the United States' hegemony in that part of the world, which is very important to it. Now, it makes sense to me that by helping a beleaguered people, the United States would gain popularity. But that's not what the United States is interested in. It's only interested in power and profits and the Saudi government assists it in achieving those unholy goals. So the fact that millions of people, including children, innocent children, and most of the men and women who are at risk also have nothing to do with any military. They're at risk of suffering horrific deaths. Death by starvation is horrific.
Sure.
And yet the United States will stand by and allow it to happen simply because it isn't interested in individuals in that part of the world. It's only interested in assuring that there are governments in that part of the world that will do its bidding.
Well, let's talk about some numbers here in terms of the U.S., Brett Yonkers, if I may. Now, in the 5 years before the war, the U.S. actually sold Saudi Arabia arms, what are called arms transfers, to the tune of about $3 billion. And then you have the years 2015 to 2020, 2015 when the war started, and you have that figure spiked to $64.1 billion, and that is a conservative estimate. We're talking about weapons, cruise missiles, et cetera. So that's roughly about $10.7 billion per year. And then you have the WFP that says it needs $813 million to continue to help with the starving children and, of course, other avenues where this money can go in terms of helping Yemenis. So, Mike, the conclusion that can be reached here, if you agree, is that the U.S. can sell weapons with this amount of revenue coming in, but it won't help Yemenis who are dying because of the weapons that it's selling, Saudi-led coalition. Is that a correct deduction?
Yes, absolutely. I think that is a very clear-cut and very to-the-point analysis. It is a fact that imperialism as a system, and especially U.S. imperialism as it has existed at least since 1945 and probably before that as well, is a system that is completely devoid of any form of humanity. They don't even think about the suffering that they are causing and the suffering that is going on in that part of the world. And even when they do mention it, when they talk about, you know, the people who are suffering and dying in Yemen or in the wider Arab world or in Africa or in Asia, they talk about it as if it is a fact of life that just happens to exist. There just happens to be poverty. There just happens to be starvation and children are dying. And then they might collect some, it's a couple of million, mostly from charity that is donated by, you know, ordinary American people and ordinary people across the West, not even really the money that comes from the government itself. And then they might send some money through some NGO or humanitarian organization to try to basically throw some, you know, drops on a hot plate in order to try, quote unquote, solve the situation that way. But what they never do is talk. They never talk about why this is happening. They never talk about the reasons. They never analyze the causes. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because the powers that be, especially the government, the media concerns, the military-industrial complex, they know very well that it is their own fault. It is their doing. They are very well aware of that. And they're trying to do everything they can in order to ensure that people don't catch on to that fact too much. Sure. They don't like to talk about the fact that Saudi Arabia would never have launched this war to begin with back in 2015 if they did not have the green light from the Obama administration back then. This is all part of a diabolical system. If there's no better way of saying it, I believe. It's a diabolical system that is all about, indeed, as the other guest said, about profit and about power. That's the only thing they care about. Even if it would be much, much cheaper to just, you know, feed the world rather than spend all the money on constructing and developing new weapons. In the end, it's about the profit for a small, very small, minuscule margin of the upper class of the society. That's the only thing that matters at this point.
Well, I'm trying to figure out, Robert Fantino, what is the thinking behind Joe Biden? Because we know on his campaign trail, he said he's going to stop the war in Yemen. When he came into office, he said that that's going to happen. But then it didn't. And he said, we are stopping arms sales except for arms that are going to be used for quote-unquote defensive purposes, okay? And then from there, we went just weeks ago where you had the $650 million sale of missiles and missile launchers, which was allowed to be sold to Saudi Arabia. So from stopping the war to the sale of defensive weapons to actually having the $650 million sale. Who is pressuring Biden? What is the thinking behind there?
Part of the pressure comes from Congress, which finances its campaign. Congress members finance their campaigns for re-election from lobbyists. and the so-called defense industry is very generous to Congress members who will do its bidding and vote for these excessive sales. Biden can justify this by saying these are defensive weapons. He can't say how Saudi Arabia is going to use them, but he can call them defensive all he wants to, but they certainly are not. But he's getting pressure from Zionists who want to defeat any nation that might pose any opposition to Israel. He's getting pressure from Congress members who want to keep the campaign dollars flowing. He is not a man of great integrity and principles. He will say whatever is politically expedient at the time, such as during the campaign, saying that he would arm sales to Saudi Arabia. He would be sure that the attacks, the constant attack on Yemen, ceases, because he knows that's what people want to hear. However, the U.S. government is not responsive to the citizenry. Their constituency, the elected officials' constituency, are lobby groups, corporations, and military contractors. So that's whose bidding they do. They'll say whatever they need to say to get elected, and then they will do what those organizations and individuals tell them to do.
Let's rewind back, Brett Yonkers, to March of 2021. That was when the U.S. President Joe Biden announced that it's going to cut its support for this particular entry set for offensive operations in Yemen, which many translated that, or many deducted or interpreted U.S.'s announcement that it would be defensive weapons that it would sell to Saudi Arabia. But it was interesting, this particular headline that said this is not going to help end the war because the U.S. Will not have any concessions to offer the Ansarullah fighters or the National Salvation Governments. When it says the U.S. will not have concessions, you kind of take a step back, saying, wait a minute, is the U.S. fighting in this war directly, or is it Saudi and the Saudi-led coalition doing the fighting? And my question to you is, many analysts have said if the U.S. wanted this war to stop, it could do so with a phone call. Is that true? Do you agree?
I think to a significant extent that is definitely true, and that is I always refer back to the statement back years ago made by then President Donald Trump, in which he talked again to the people at a rally, again like Mr. Fantino said, to the people, telling the people what they want to hear. But he told people that he spoke to the King of Saudi Arabia, to King Salman. And that he told King Salman that he has to bear in mind that without U.S. support, his regime would crumble. Now, whether or not he actually, you know, said that to King Salman in person is irrelevant. The thing is that is basically a lapsus by Donald Trump, in which he spoke a rare gem of absolute truth, because that is definitely what is going on here. And that's why I say, we say that this is Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's war. And in a way, it is. He is the one who has been steering it internally. He is the one who has been pulling the power to himself internally in Saudi Arabia. But behind Saudi Arabia are these vested interests of the imperialist powers of the world. Most importantly, the United States. Saudi Arabia is, as a country, was founded by the United Kingdom, by British imperialism, and later on was basically handed over, instead of British imperialists, their main backers and main supporters nowadays, their bosses in a way, are the United States. So the Saudis as a regime are incredibly weak, because this is a kingdom built almost exclusively on petroleum. They are trying now, they had an entire agenda 2030, which has been failing for the most part, in which they're trying to diversify their economy. But they have this concept of they believe that they can live in unbridled and unlimited luxury, mm-hmm. based on nothing else except for oil and U.S. support. So I believe this is definitely true indeed, and as you see, when the United States says we won't give any concessions, what they mean is that they will not want to give in at all to what Ansarullah or the National Salvation Government of Yemen are demanding, which is an inclusive democratic government
indeed.
For all the people in Yemen. That is the goal of the revolution in 2014. But when the United States says that they are not making concessions. That is, I think, the reason why Saudi Arabia still continues this war. We know there have been whistleblowers several times already. We know that the Saudi armies and the Saudi high command knows that this war is unwinnable. We know that there are politicians and princes even in the Al Saud family who have spoken out in private, of course, against this conflict because exactly. They know this is unwinnable. But still, they will continue. And the only way the Saudis know how to continue this war, because they don't dare to send actual Saudi troops to fight and die in the desert in Yemen, the only way they know to continue this war is by bombing. That's all they have been, that sure. They know. They try to bomb as much as they can. And I think this comes, the directive indeed, the order in the end, comes from the Pentagon, comes from the CIA, and comes from the White House.
We're not only talking about the U.S. here, Robert Fantina. We're also talking about other countries that are selling arms to Yemen, such as France and the UK. And one of the most disturbing facts on top of all the other ones, which is the latest UN figures, has said that more than 16 million Yemenis, about half of the approximately 30 million population, is going to face hunger this year, and 50,000 are already starving to death. You know, you have to take a deep breath here, and I'm ending this spotlight with this question to you. There's a large failure that's taking place on a humanitarian level across the world when it comes to Yemen. A movement needs to be occurring here, especially with the fact that the WFP says that the funds are not there. How do you suggest that the world can move forward on this?
Well, first of all, it's appalling to think that in 2021, this many people are facing starvation. Not only hunger, but starvation resulting in death. The countries of the world have the resources to prevent this. It's just a matter of their will. As we've seen in the past, the governments will not act until the people within their countries demand that they act. This means voting out people who are only concerned about power and profits. It means supporting candidates who are willing to make changes, make significant changes in the way their governments are operating, and especially in their foreign policies in this context. England and France, and certainly the United States, are complicit in all of Saudi Arabia's war crimes and crimes against humanity. The people in those countries do not necessarily support these horrific crimes, but they need to act to see that the government officials who are complicit are removed from office. Additionally, NGOs need to take a huge step. Their hands are tied, certainly, because they're afraid of being bombed, and it's a reasonable fear if they go into Yemen. But these organizations need to act and act in opposition to the governments under which they live in order to see that the people of Yemen do not starve to death by the millions, which is the current threat.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. That's Robert Fantina, author, journalist, and activist from Kushner. And Brett Yonkers, thank you for your contribution. Historian and journalist there from Hessel. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks so much. Until next time, from me, Kaveh Tahwe, the entire team in the capital of Tehran, it's goodbye.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about Ayatollah Khamenei's Islamic laws on prayer and prayer rules, and we started, in fact, a couple of episodes on the prayer rules, let me ask you this question, which might be the question of lots of people, especially in megacities. Well, it does seem to me that, you know, in fact, in lots of these mega cities, the time difference between the east and the west of those cities are so vast and so large that so much that one might be suspicious of the azan, which comes in the morning, for example, as an just an example.
Yeah.
All right. Like, for example, in some countries like Iran, the azan for the morning, or the morning azan, the Fajr azan, might look a little bit too early, in fact,
yeah,
for some people, right?
Yeah.
Well, don't you think that one might be better off exercising some precaution in this regard. Like, for example, like wait, for example, for a couple of minutes and then offer his prayer.
Yeah, you're right. Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei has said that it is more precautionary to wait for some minutes until you are certain that the time has set in, you know. And just as you rightly mentioned, of course, there are some very big cities.
Mm-hmm.
The eastern part of the city and the western part of the city are they are poles apart, you know, from
yes.
each other.
Yes.
And of course, it takes you, let's say, hours to move from one corner of the city to another.
Yes.
So that's why the adhan is said by and the adhan is said by the radio or by the mosques.
Yes.
And all of those mosques start praying, giving the adhan or saying the adhan at the same time. So that's why His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei has said that we need to wait for some minutes as a measure of precaution. But if a person wants to offer his prayers as soon as the adhan is said, there's no objection to him. But the precaution is to wait for some minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a matter of precaution only.
I see. Okay, Sheikh, another question, in fact, what are the ways through which one might be able to learn about the time of the prayer or when the prayer, in fact, or their azan has set in, their
yeah.
time?
First of all, the duty-bound or the mukallaf, in fact, must himself should become certain or he should become sure that the time has set in. Okay?
Yes.
If he is certain, then he is certain. He should act according to his certainty, and he should not. He cannot go against what he believes to be. You know, when you believe that the time has set in, you should start praying. Okay, and you have every reason to say that the time has set in, and you have every reason to start praying. So that's one way of making sure, or one way of ascertaining the time for prayer.
Mm-hmm.
If you are not in a position, if you are not able to determine the beginning of the time, or of course, then you need to ask two witnesses who are reliable, who are trustworthy, and who are, let's say, adil. You know, they are just. They are just. You know, an adil person or a just person is one who does not commit haram publicly, and whose appearance indicates or suggests that he is a person who can be trusted.
Yes.
So he does not lie. He does not tell a lie. He's not, for example, he does not do anything which is illegal in according to Islamic Sharia. So he's an adil person. So if two individuals announce or tell you that the time for prayer has set in, then you can trust them and you can start praying.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe if there is, for example, a muadhin or someone who calls for prayer. He is a muadhin. A muadhin, a person who is the caller to prayer. So if a muadhin who is trustworthy and who knows the time, and you also know him that he is such a person, and he announces, calls for prayer, then you can trust him and, of course, start praying.
Mm-hmm.
These are some ways to determine the beginning of the time for prayer.
Mm, thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad. hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, here sitting in the studio with me, and we are talking about the prayer rules according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Well, Sheikh, you know, we know that when the time for the prayer has set in, if you are in a Middle Eastern or a Muslim country, usually there is the call, you know, to prayer, or there is the azan, which is very much loud and clear through the loudspeakers everywhere, or from the minarets of the mosques.
Yes.
But if you're living in a non-Muslim country, usually it's somehow difficult to determine whether the prayer time has set in or not. If one wonders or is doubtful what time is the exact or accurate prayer time, what should they do? Should they start offering their prayers?
His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei says it clearly that if a person is not certain and has not and does not have any means by which he could become certain that the time has set in, of course, he cannot pray. Because if he prays, his prayer is void.
Uh-huh.
Because he's not certain. But he can wait until he is certain. So as long as you are not certain, you cannot start praying. Like, for example, Dhuhr prayer, Fajr prayer, Maghrib prayer. So it is necessary to be certain that the time for a prayer has set in. And as long as you are not certain, you cannot start praying.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not, you know, clear whether you are going to offer your prayer within the prescribed time or maybe out of the prescribed time, before the time. So your prayer, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, is invalid.
I see. But that would be, in fact, too difficult to determine the prayer time if you have no access to internet, for example.
Yes.
All right? Sure. You're probably in a village or somewhere like that, and you don't have the internet access to you available. And also, it would be very difficult about the morning azan.
Yeah.
You know, when you're talking about, like, you have to wait, well, the time difference between the noon prayer and its qada time is so huge. It's so much. Yes. It's a couple of hours. But for the morning, it's not very much.
1 hour and 30 minutes.
It's about 1 hour, basically.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it would be too difficult to wait.
To wait.
And yes. Too difficult to determine this prayer time.
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, they go out to work. They go out to work. And maybe on their way to work, they need to pray. They need to pull over and offer their prayers at the roadside, you know. Mm-hmm. We are not talking about ourselves, you know, because we live in a Muslim country.
Yes.
We can. It's very much easy for us.
Yes.
Because we hear the adhan and we act according to the adhan. But for Muslims living in the West, of course, it's very difficult to tell the time. And they always have problems.
Challenging, yes.
It's kind of challenging for them.
Sheikh, is it obligatory to wait until the very adhan is completed and then start praying or not?
It's not necessary to wait, you know. Uh-huh. As soon as the azan, you know, is
or the beginning expressions were just out.
When the muazzin or the person calling to prayer starts giving adhan or pronouncing, then that is the time, you know. It means he has become certain about the time and he is now calling people to prayer. So that's the time, and it's not necessary for you to actually wait until the azan is completed and then you offer your prayers. No, that's not necessary.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
محيي المؤمنين. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres landed in Beirut on Sunday to follow up several issues, including Lebanon's economic crisis. In a press conference, he described as saddening and heartbreaking the situation in Lebanon.
I am also gravely concerned about the impact of the economic and financial crisis in the country, causing ever more people to need humanitarian assistance. Yesterday, I visited Tripoli in North Lebanon, and today Tyre in the south. And I was very moved when listening to first-hand testimonies of how the crisis is impacting people's daily lives.
During his visit, the United Nations chief met President Michel Aoun and stressed that the United Nations stands in solidarity with Lebanon in its crisis. After meeting with Speaker Nabi Hibiri, the head of the UN recognized the Israeli violations of Lebanon's airspace.
The opportunity to discuss the presence of UNIFIL in southern Lebanon, the need to end with all violations of the ceasefire, and in particular, the speaker has drawn my attention to the violations of the airspace of Lebanon, and also the need for total implementation of the resolutions of the Security Council.
The UN chief called on the Lebanese political leaders to show unity in order to carry out fundamental reforms and continue talks with the International Monetary Fund. Analysts question whether the UN can have any tangible impact on the situation in Lebanon in light of U.S. sanctions and Israeli violations.
The question we need to ask today is, can the UN change the reality on the ground, especially since there are U.S. economic sanctions and there are daily Israeli violations against Lebanon? Up until now, we have not seen any practical measures from the UN to at least stop these violations and the injustice which the Lebanese people are subject to because of its support for the resistance and its fight to have full sovereignty over its country.
Guterres also visited Prime Minister Najib Mikati and lauded Lebanon's generosity in being a place where Syrians and Palestinians took refuge. The United Nations chief urged the international community to provide more financial assistance to Lebanon, which is grappling with a myriad of crises, especially an unprecedented economic collapse. Yet most Lebanese doubt that these words would be translated into measures to stop U.S. sanctions against Lebanon. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
In recent weeks, tensions between Russia on one side and Ukraine and the US and NATO on the other have reached an alarming new level, raising fears of an armed conflict. The two sides have time and time again accused each other of provoking a military escalation in Ukraine and warned of serious consequences. In the latest development, the Russian president has blamed the West for escalating tensions in Europe, citing NATO's eastward expansion and the U.S. withdrawal from missile treaties like the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty and the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. The Russian leader has also warned that his country is prepared to take military technical measures in response to unfriendly Western actions over Ukraine.
Russia stands for equal and indivisible security throughout the Eurasian area. Of course, as I have already noted, if our Western colleagues continue their aggressive course of action, we will take adequate military and technical actions in response. We will react toughly to unfriendly steps. And I want to emphasize, we have every right to do so. We have every right to take actions aimed at ensuring the security and sovereignty of Russia.
The warning comes as the US and its European allies have stepped up their anti-Russia rhetoric under the pretext that Moscow is building up its troops to invade Ukraine. Russia argues that it's the US and NATO that are infringing upon it with an eastward expansion and by arming Ukraine under false excuses. Russia has also demanded legal security guarantees regarding the situation around Ukraine. In the draft security pacts published on Friday, Russia urged NATO to give up any military activity in Eastern Europe and Ukraine and roll back the deployment of its troops and weapons. However, many experts have cast doubt on the possibility of reaching an agreement between the US and Russia, saying even if Washington accepts such terms, there is still no guarantee that it remains committed to them.
If we look at it contemporarily, US promises and guarantees and even signed treaties and negotiations mean nothing. I mean, Iran knows this with the JCPOA, the different nuclear treaties which have been violated by the United States unilaterally. So these are worthless, and I doubt that they will actually make any agreement.
The United States, especially under the presidency of Joe Biden, has made its best efforts to provide military support to Ukraine, which lies on Russia's doorstep. In September, Washington signed a new cooperation agreement in the field of defense and security with Kiev. In the meantime, the U.S. is training military personnel in the Eastern European country, upgrading the country's ports to fit its warships and supplying it annually with hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid. The Biden administration's policies show that Washington is trying to keep tensions escalating to reduce Russia's influence in Eastern Europe, and Ukraine seems to be the best place to aim this goal. Russia, on the other hand, argues that while Ukraine is free to decide the security arrangements, those cannot threaten Russia's interests and security, insisting that Ukraine joining the NATO military alliance would cross a red line. As tensions between Russia and NATO over Ukraine are escalating, there are serious concerns about the potential for military escalation, potentially to the point of full-blown war.
Divine verses are recited by the most euphonious voices, and the best recitations will win the award of the 44th Quran competition in Iran. 200 contestants are competing in the Quranic event in two sections of female and male competitions and in seven different fields, including recitation, memorization, and interpretation.
Last year, the competition was held online due to pandemic. I'm so happy that this year is being held physically. I'm competing in recitation section and I hope I will win the contest.
The Holy Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad some 14 centuries ago to teach humanity how to live in peace. It preaches us against any kind of discrimination and intolerance. So it's good to recite the Quran with a beautiful voice and win a prize here in this contest. But at the same time, we need to pay attention to the divine instructions in order to benefit from this holy book.
The event is organized by the Endowment and Charity Affairs Organization. It says one of the major goals of this competition is to encourage the youth to keep their touch with the holy book of Quran at a time when technology has distracted societies from religious teachings.
The average age of the participants in the contest is below 30 years. This is very promising and shows that previous editions of the competition have been successful in attracting the youth and teens to the Holy Quran and its rich instructions.
The Quranic contest is held at a national scale, but at the same time, it's a preparatory stage for the International Quran Competition, which will be held next year in Iran, where finalists of this event will compete with international contestants.
Every Muslim family has the Holy Quran in their houses to read its verses and ponder its divine messages to mankind. Messages that can leave a deeper impact on listeners through these melodious recitations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The sights and smells of home, from Palestinian traditional clothes to signature Palestinian dishes. Roughly 6 million Palestinians live in exile after 73 years of illegal Israeli occupation, which denies them the right to return.
Events like this bring together Palestinians from all walks of life, but the main target is the younger generation.
It's very important to bring my children to an event like this, to learn more about Palestine, about the struggle of the Palestinian people. Myself, I was born in a refugee camp in the Gaza Strip. They were born in Britain. They probably have no connection with Palestine whatsoever. So it's very important that we bring our kids to these events to learn more about the struggle of their own people.
The public isn't really educated about the occupation that's going on in Palestine, and they kind of think just because it's going on for so long that it's something that's normal and dismissed, whereas events like this show us that it's not normal and we should fight for what we believe in.
It can never be just about art and culture. The festival, like the ones before, was also unapologetically political. The organizers called once again on the international community to end the occupation of Palestine. Former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, was there to offer his support as well.
Nobody ever chooses to be a refugee. Nobody ever wants to leave their home, their community, their family, their place of birth, possibly never to return. They don't do it for fun. They do it out of desperation.
We asked Mr. Corbyn about the new Borders and Nationality Bill, which is being described as the most racist legislation in decades and could harm those seeking asylum in the UK.
Oppose the Borders and Nationality Bill. It's brutal, it's unnecessary, and it's demonising people who are desperate. Nobody gets into a boat to cross the English Channel unless they're really desperate. They are desperate people who end up on the shores of this country. They should be supported, they should be housed, they should be welcomed, because they're people fleeing from poverty, from oppression, and from environmental degradation.
The former Labour leader, who represents a growing number of British citizens and politicians that support the Palestinian cause, has been a figurehead of the resistance for decades, bringing hope to young Palestinians who dream of returning to their homeland. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Israeli military intelligence chief Tamir Heyman has admitted in an interview that Tel Aviv was involved in the January 2020 assassination of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, in a drone strike that also killed deputy chief of Iraq's popular mobilization unit, Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis, at Baghdad airport. The headline, however, didn't come as a surprise given initial reports on the role of informants in tipping the CIA about the whereabouts of the Iranian general on the day of the U.S. drone strike. It's not the first time Israel has been involved in such operations against Iran either. The regime assassinated four Iranian scientists between 2010 and 2012. In November last year, Iran's top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was assassinated in an attack that Iran says has Israel's fingerprints all over it. Tehran also points its finger at Tel Aviv for multiple sabotage attacks that have recently hit Iran's nuclear facilities in an abortive attempt to undermine the country's nuclear program. Despite Iran's repeated calls on the international community to hold the perpetrators responsible for the dangerous adventurism, neither the United Nations nor self-proclaimed promoters of human rights in the West have called for accountability or made any meaningful attempt to prevent similar attacks. That's also true about Israel's military action on nations like Syria and the regime's atrocities against the people of Palestine, all of which are considered as blatant violation of international law.
Because of the protection of the United States in the United Nations Security Council, flat out, this is what enables Israel to perpetuate its rogue activity regionally and globally, to perpetuate its terrorism, to perpetuate its ethnic cleansing and genocide against the Palestinian people, to continually bomb neighboring countries almost daily. It is the protection of the United States in the United Nations that enables Israel to act in this continually terroristic and scofflaw manner.
That begs the question, wouldn't the lack of international accountability legitimize Israel's state terrorism and embolden the regime to intensify its aggression?
The largest international gathering on Afghanistan since the U.S. left the country in a chaotic situation. The extraordinary meeting of the OIC foreign ministers was convened in Islamabad to discuss the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. The meeting was attended by not just the OIC states, but permanent members of the UN Security Council, representatives of the UN agencies, and the international financial institutions. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan called for the immediate help for the people of Afghanistan.
The point is that if the world does not act, this will be the biggest man-made crisis which is unfolding in front of us. The OIC, it's a big responsibility on us, because not only is it the situation in Afghanistan as it unfolds, but it's a religious duty to help them.
The UN Under Secretary General on Humanitarian Affairs presented a grim picture of the Afghan situation.
Basic services that all Afghans depend on are collapsing as international development support, upon which the country has depended for so long, has frozen up. By the middle of next year, as estimated by UNDP, universal poverty may reach 97%.
The Iranian foreign minister proposed the establishment of a special fund to help the people of Afghanistan. He also called for the national reconciliation and inclusive government in Afghanistan. This was the second extraordinary meeting of the OIC on Afghanistan. The first one was also held in Islamabad 41 years ago, but the agenda at that time was to penalize the Soviet-backed regime in Kabul.
The meeting of the OIC foreign ministers came against the backdrop of worsening humanitarian situation in Afghanistan. According to the United Nations, nearly 23 million Afghans are facing acute food shortage. 97% of Afghan population could slip below the poverty line by June next year if urgent steps are not taken to mitigate their sufferings.
The acting Afghan foreign minister was also invited to the meeting. Officials say at this stage the priority is to avert the humanitarian crisis, and the question of recognition of the Taliban rule will come later. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Anger was vented outside Downing Street Sunday as Britain's ethnic minorities demanded the government scrap the controversial new Nationality and Border Bill. The bill gifts the state new powers to remove citizenship without warning or a proper appeal process. Black, Asian and immigrant families are all expected to be targeted disproportionately by the new law change, sending fear ricocheting through communities.
Basically, what they're saying is that all that we've been working for as organizations, as generations of Muslims who exist in this country, belong to this country, whatever you've done doesn't really matter. You're a second-class citizen. And that is a dangerous narrative that they're presenting us with.
The fact that even though you're a British citizen, you're still affected if you're still from an ethnic minority country. So the fact that you're a member of the Sikh community, Muslim community, Hindu community, black community, you're not really safe here.
As members of the public, as just citizens of Britain, we are just pawns, mere pawns to them in their political games. Our lives are at stake, and that is not an exaggeration.
Despite government reassurances, critics have warned that the new bill could affect an estimated 6 million Britons who were born elsewhere or have a second nationality, and could be used by the state to punish minority citizens they want to get rid of.
The bill has already passed through the House of Commons at its third reading earlier this month. It's now been passed onto the House of Lords, where it will be debated further on January the 5th. The result of that debate could determine whether so many British citizens, particularly from ethnic minorities, can maintain their nationality going forward. Robert Carter, London.